Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of intraretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today, on episode 431, we are previewing the June 2024 edition of Retinal Physician. Remember that Retinal Physician can be found online and in print for free. The website is retinalphysician.com. Doctors Yoshi Nokawa and Sarwar Zahi joining for this episode. We discussed diabetic retinopathy for most of it, and with the discussion of chlorhexidine versus betadine prophylaxis for antiseptic injection prep. Remember, you can claim CME credits for older episodes by clicking on the link in the episode description, and you can see a list of relevant financial disclosures in the episode description.
Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now back with a preview of the June 2024 edition of Retinal Physician. As a reminder, Retinal Physician can be found online at retinalphysician.com and also in print for free. Joining me for today's episode, I have two of my colleagues from around the country. First, in alphabetical order, Dr. Yoshi Yonakawa, who's in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Yoshi, welcome back.
I am so excited. Dude, this is the first time that I'm first being in alphabetical order.
I'm alphabetically challenged. But yeah. Even I could figure out that Y comes before Z, because Dr. Sarwar Zahid is joining us from New York. Sarwar, welcome.
Nice. Good to be back. You're welcome, Yoshi. I got you, bro.
I love you. Thank
Always
you.
Depend on me, man.
Yeah, you know, there was someone once wrote me asking, they were sort of joking, and I think we talked about this before. I have never sat and done the numbers. They're saying that a remarkable, they joked that I was biased towards people with last names towards the end of the alphabet, because the vast majority of the people who come on have letters T and beyond as their last name, which I never thought about. I mean, maybe that's, so I don't think I'm consciously biased. I think it's just random, but it is sort of interesting that most of the time we're towards the end of the alphabet. Yoshi, you're usually last, Sarwar is still last. We haven't found someone, a ZO or a ZI somewhere to take your place, but maybe a Zamora somewhere to fill in. Anyway, so we have these articles. The theme of this month's issue was diabetic retinopathy. Again, you can go read these articles separately if you'd like. These are articles that we'll summarize here and use them as jumping off points for discussion. So first kind of thought was the concept of what do you use to stage diabetic retinopathy? And there's two sort of separate articles. There's an article by David Lally with Peter Kaiser on it called The Evolution of Clinical Trial Endpoints for Diabetic Retinopathy. Basically talking about how the ETRS has been the gold standard for a long time with diabetic retinopathy severity scores that we use in all of our trials, essentially, to quantify diabetic retinopathy. And now they talk about some of the limitations of ETRS photography. One, it was used fundus photography that didn't cover most of the retina. Two, it really didn't give you any sort of idea if a PDR patient was getting better or worse. It didn't talk about how DR could regress, because at the time, DR regression was not something that was really well understood, nor happened very often compared to the anti-VEGF era. And a lot of this times into the modernization, right? DME being incorporated, and how do you talk about anti-VEGF treatment? And they talk about the different options, right? There's a scale, which is the binocular 17-step scale, which incorporates visual, that incorporates sort of different granular stages, right? So you can break things up more, one eye, both eyes, patients with mild, moderate, or high risk PDR, try to be a little more granular, which may be more useful for trials. And then we have this other article also talking about development of endpoints. And this was The Continuing Evolution of Diabetic Retinal Disease Staging by Daniel Kiernan from Sarasota. And again, same thing, talking about maybe you can use not just fundus photography, but is it OCT, adaptive optics, fluorescein, something else to develop scales that would be more helpful, right? So Yoshi, you guys do a lot of clinical trials at Wills, and obviously you're up to date with a lot of these clinical trials. I think this is something that people have talked about. You know, how do you sort of incorporate wide field angiography, newer findings into clinical trials? I would imagine, you know, you do ROP and other things that require staging that has to be standardized. One of the difficulties with changing a whole staging system is it has to be validated before you employ it. And then it gets a lot harder to do apples to apples comparisons until you really switch over most trials to the same staging system, because that's one of the advantages of ETRS, is you can sort of do some DRSS comparisons a little bit trial to trial, or pool larger collections of data. I mean, what are your thoughts on the development of a new staging system in general? Like, how would you roll this out? How do you sort of get people to start to switch over? Because I think the imaging technology has advanced to the point where it's reasonable. It's just a question now of how do you decide what is the most important factor to track?
I think, staging systems, it's important, one, for clinical research, but it has to be very practical for everyday use. And so, like, the ROP staging, it's great. It's very practical. DRSS, it's great for clinical trials, but not really in our practices. Like, how often are we, like, you know, counting every single flame hemorrhage and figuring out the DRSS score? Probably never, right? I mean, we're thinking more like mild, moderate, severe in terms of NPDR in clinic, looking at how much, you know, hemorrhage there is. And so I agree that the peripheral retina is really important. It's really interesting. And I do agree that, you know, DME is not incorporated into the staging system currently, which I think is an issue. And that in the anti-VEGF era, the eyes may be behaving differently. However, I'm not sure if wide field fluorescein is really the answer from a practical standpoint, because while as much as I love wide field fluorescein, I'm a huge advocate for it, but you know, it's not available for every single office, every single practice, and we can't create a system where we mandate every practice, every office to have a very expensive piece of equipment. That's kind of like ivory tower medicine, right? And in the future, I think that machine learning will be a big thing. And right now we have FDA approved devices that diagnose diabetic retinopathy, but doesn't really predict how it's gonna do. And also, as retina doctors, we don't need someone to tell us what the diagnosis is, because we do know this kind of diagnostic tool is best in PCP offices. But what we cannot do yet is predicting the future, which is what I think the new staging systems will try to aim for. And I think that'll be important.
Yeah, and to that point, you know, to be fair, there's going to be some old school people who listen who say, well, the whole reason that the scale was developed is because patients who were mild had this risk of progression to complications, and moderate this risk, and this percentage risk for severe. So there's a devil's advocate point, which is it was supposed to predict the future in a sense by the whole reason you stage is to say that there's X percentage chance of risk. The question is, again, it becomes a very wide swath. If you're lumping all mild NPDR patients together, are they all going to have the same risk of progression? I think all of us practically would say no, who are ophthalmologists or retina specialists. Sarwar, to Yoshi's point about machine learning and predicting the future, I mean, it's possible that the scale would be something that's black box, right? People have talked about AI models that would essentially be able to quantify risk, right? And that would allow you to assign it in two categories, and the machine could decide its own categories based on risk quantification for factors we don't even fully understand. But then you would imagine that unless there was convergent evolution where multiple AIs sort of ended up at the same point, you could have three different AI systems that all look at slightly different things but end up at the same answer, right? Because there may be more than one factor we're looking at in a fundus photo or an FA that contributes to risk for that individual patient. I think standardization would, again, be an issue unless we decided on a standardized sort of AI or machine learning algorithm that is the defined standard for our field.
And the standardization is like the hardest thing, because I think, you know, as Yoshi mentioned, I mean, the hardest part is, you know, most of us, as we're going through busy clinics, we're sort of risk stratifying automatically. These scores are really important. And, you know, like, for example, for me personally, like if I one thing that I pay a lot of attention to is the level of diabetic control. I think if there's ongoing poor glycemic control, if there's a way to incorporate that into these scores, because I think that, I mean, some of these great articles refer to the fact that, yes, you know, it's not just if you're mild, moderate, or severe what your score is. You know, if you continue to have an A1C above, say, 8, your likelihood of developing PDR gets much worse. You know, that's why whenever I tell patients, you know, all our patients ask us, oh, my diabetes has been under better control. But, you know, why do I still need injections? And, you know, we just have to tell them we're dealing with the damage that was done before. But we have to reassure them that, like, hey, you know, you're still preventing worsening of the disease. You're preventing further damage. I think the AI component is going to be very important here, because these scores, I mean, I think we need to adjust some of these scores. And I don't know, I'm not familiar with any data that looked at stratifying these scores in people who've gotten anti-VEGF therapy in the past. Because presumably what is the level of correction that's happening? I mean, the hope is that there's some sort of AI model where you can plug in the score, before, plug in the score after, whether that's, from an AI model or not. Their current A1C and the number of injections that they got, or their last injection. There's so much we don't understand, right? Like, for example, at what point is that regression of the DRSS score after anti-VEGF? At what point is it okay that they got their last injection 3 months ago? Like, for example, when I do an FA, I pay attention to when the last FA was done. So there's so many other factors, especially with the presence of DME, because that totally changes how we interpret these scores.
Yeah, and at that point, Yoshi, it would be interesting to see. You may have a different point. I was thinking it would be interesting if machine learning could help us decide for that patient, the patient who's got an anti-VEGF, who's at risk of who's truly converted, let's say, from our old grading from severe to mild and now is going to stay there. Who is there some factor in the imaging or something we can't see that the AI could detect that say, you know what, this patient looks like they've gotten better, but they're pretty high risk. They have a 60% risk that if you stop treatment, they're going to slide back into severe NPDR range. That would be sort of interesting too, because I do think that there is something there that would predict that would be picked up by something more sophisticated than the human eye.
Yeah, ChatGPT 4.0 was just released, I think, a few days ago. So let's see what 4.0 says. Getting back to this article about diabetic retinopathy staging, one of the articles mentioned the Mary Tyler Moore Vision Initiative. And I know this podcast is about retinal physician, but just a shout out about that initiative. They published a paper in 2022 about their first workshop. It was published in a TVST, that's Translational Vision Science and Technology, the new journal from ARVO. And that's a really good read, where they gathered like all the thought leaders and people from industry and policymakers. And it summarizes each of their talks. So that's a very good read if anyone's interested.
Awesome. And let's talk. We have three other articles covered, but we can always bring back this point. The next thing was about impact of glycemic control and hypoglycemia on diabetic retinopathy. By Khurram Chaudhary and a team from Stony Brook. And again, as just a summary of this, I mean, there's kind of three big take-home points. The first big take-home point is we know that A1C poor control, we all know, has been correlated with higher risk of development of retinopathy, higher risk of development of severe retinopathy, and higher risk of complications of diabetic retinopathy as that goes along. However, it is interesting to think about hypoglycemia because there have been some studies talking about hypoglycemia worsens. We talked about this before. The idea, and we had a recent journal club actually about this very topic, about is there a hypoglycemia? Can it induce worsening of retinopathy, whether that's transient or more permanent? And what happens to those complications? And what does that mean for how we treat or manage these patients? I think, Sarah, we have in our one we previewed recently about GLP-1 agonists, right? Could GLP-1 agonists be implicated in the worsening of retinopathy? And they talked through some of the things. And the third point would be early worsening of diabetic retinopathy. It was observed before with insulin. Could it be observed with certain medications like GLP-1 now? And they talk about kind of the mechanisms, but in the end, I think one of the big takeaways are you do want to get the sugar control better. It's just what do you do in the meantime? Sarwar, again, you were on that episode, I believe, we talked about this. So, not to beat a dead horse, but you can sort of summarize your thoughts. You see a lot of diabetic patients in your practice who, especially after you read them the Riot Act, or you are the one who tells them, hey, you need to take care of yourself, you're losing vision. That's a positive thing when they go out and they do get improved. Their PCP and them work together, endocrinology work together to get better. My question is, what do you do in terms of monitoring those patients differently, right? For those who missed the other episode, do you do anything different for the patients who come in with an A1C of 11 and then you're like, hey, they're on the right track, their A1C is now down to 7 or 6? Are you more worried about them? Like, does this factor into your follow-up at all?
It has in the even since that journal club when we talked about this, there were a few patients right where they had maybe mild to moderate NPDR last year, a couple of years ago, and I did focal for their DME and they're back and all of a sudden they have florid PDR, and when I asked them about their history, they're like, yeah, I'm taking Ozempic, and I'm taking it, and it's because of that experience and also some of the data that we went over. I mean, and we also know that the speed at which the improvement happens can be fairly rapid. And the way I mean, I love this article because I went over some of the mechanisms like the hypoxia-induced factor And I mean, the way I think about this is like, whenever you talk about reperfusion injury and like myocardial infarction, I remember like some of the issues with reperfusion injury. And it's sort of the way I whenever I think about it, it's like, oh, of course it's going to be a worse thing because you were depriving the system of something and now you're improving it or you're changing the homeostasis. So I it was fun to nerd out about this, but I actually see those patients even at baseline if they're severe in PDR. I see them and they have ongoing poor control. I see them sooner within 3 to 4 months, assuming no DME. But now, if I know that they're on a medication that they're taking regularly, that may very rapidly improve their glycemic control. Because a lot of times, we have so many patients that, like, yeah, I just started metformin. And you see them back 3, 4 months later, and their A1C is not that significantly reduced. With some of these newer agents, the speed at which, and I think this is one thing that I want to see more of, and maybe in the non-ophthalmic literature, there's more of this data at the speed at which the A1C drops. I'm following those patients a bit closer, even for earlier stages of retinopathy.
Yeah, Yoshi, and I suggested that hypothetical to Sarwar, right? Patient goes from A1C of 11, now they're 6.5. I think we'd all say that's still better than them being at 11 6 months later, because staying at 11 is also not good for your retinopathy. But maybe, as Sarwar's point, maybe if it was 11 to 9 and then to 8, and it was more gradual, it's just hard to titrate that because we don't necessarily have, and I don't want to speak ignorant, and someone who knows more about other specialties can speak to this. I've never seen data for other fields that said, hey, if you rapidly go from an A1C of 11 to 6, now your CKD worsens in terms of its stage, or your risk of MI is higher going from 11 to 6 from 11 to 8. So the question is, would the systemic benefits even warrant a slow reduction if you don't have those same ripple effects in other parts of the body? So thoughts on anything Sarwar said or this article?
Yeah, I agree that it was nerdy, and I mean that as a compliment. I love the molecular mechanism of HIF-1 alpha. It's all about that, right? The relative hypoglycemia inducing HIF-1 alpha causing more NV and edema. And I agree that well, let's talk practical terms. I think a lot of us are being asked by patients and endocrinologists, hey, can we start this patient on GLP-1 receptor agonist? Many patients are also aware, because on the box it says worsening retinopathy as a risk. And I always tell the patients to do whatever their endocrinologist recommends in terms of controlling their diabetes, because as long as the patients can keep their appointments with us as retina doctors, we can control the retinopathy, right? And so we just have to make sure that the patients maintain their follow-up. Thankfully, we have the treatments that can keep them under control. And so whether it's rapid or gradual glycemic control, I think, the paper also showed long-term that the retinopathy does better if you control it. And one kind of public service announcement about patients on GLP-1 receptor agonists as retina doctors. And so in addition to the worsening retinopathy that's transient, it also has an effect in terms of surgery. And so GLP-1 receptor agonists, it also delays gastric emptying. And so you have more of your gastric contents kind of laying around. So if you're to have surgery, you're at increased risk for aspiration. And so if you have a patient with vitreous hemorrhage or a TRD and you have to take them to the OR, look at their medication list. And you'll probably want to stop their Ozempic for 1 or 2 weeks before the surgery if it's something that's elective, relatively elective, and you can plan that ahead of time.
Yeah.
Huge thing. I've had a lot of surgeries recently canceled for this specific reason, as they've applied to the SGLT2 blockers. The anesthesia world, and I think like surgery centers are also all changing their protocols. And this is within the last 6 months, where now the new guidelines are, you have to be off these medications for a week. And that's something we all have to, it's a great point, Yoshi.
Not again, this is going to feel like a real switching gears because it's sort of in the DR realm, but Priya Vakharia and David Eichenbaum, the next article we're going to talk about, they talked about gene therapy for diabetic retinopathy. So to this idea, right, like we it kind of ties into both things we're talking about, right? The idea of what happens when the medication treatment effect wanes to the DR severity, and also to how do you manage the patient who may be going through external factors that worsen their retinopathy. And the idea would be if you could do transgene therapy for diabetic retinopathy, where you could get, let's say, VEGF as one target to be produced, anti-VEGF as a target to be produced and produced and produced, then it would eliminate not only the need for multiple injections, but perhaps be preventative. If it was something that was able to be easily delivered to multiple patients, perhaps we would deliver this one day in a pipe dream for all patients who are moderately severe, severe MPDR for prevent protection versus doing pan-retinal laser, which has been sort of the standard of care for a long time. And so they talk a little bit about the two major clinical trials for diabetic retinopathy and DME. Altitude is the RGX-314, that's the adenovirus 8 vector that design that produces essentially a ranibizumab similar molecule. And then there's the Spectra trial, which is intravitreal 4150 for DME and uses an evolved intravitreal vector R100, not an AAV8. And this was a designed viral vector rather than using the adenovirus. And so Spectra is enrolled as of September 2023. We're going to get results in 2024. For RG14, just working our way back, RGX14, so far, so good. There was a little bit of an incidence of episcleritis. The one-year results were announced in 2023 for the phase two trial. I think we would love to get more data as we follow these patients for longer, but 89% of the treatment patients had reduction in vision threatening events compared to control. So, and Yoshi, we've talked about this, I think, ad nauseum, but the delivery mechanism is really important here, right? You know, one, you're delivering the drug intravitreally. The other one now is suprachoroidal system. Both can be given in office, but maybe one more familiar to providers than suprachoroidal. But either way, either of these or both of these hitting the market, assuming that they're reasonably cost effective and approved by insurers, could be an absolute game changer. And maybe it would change the paradigm at what stage we decide to intervene with injections.
Yeah, I think, you know, these are going to be real players in our next couple of years, right? And I think suprachoroidal has huge benefits. Intravitreal, we'll see what the 4DMT trials shows, but intravitreal tends to cause more inflammation. Subretinal delivery through vitrectomy causes the least, but you need a big surgery for it. Not a big surgery, but it's surgery, and people usually don't like that. Suprachoroidal, you can do it in the office. It works really well. And I've been using a lot of suprachoroidal triamcinolone recently. And, you know, it's not that hard. And so I think there's, you know, a lot of a good value proposition for that. However, I think that there's a big use case for DME and wet AMD, but I'm not so sure about diabetic retinopathy itself, like NPDR without DME. And remember, you know, a few years ago with the Panorama study, and there was a lot of hype over treating diabetic retinopathy without edema. There's like so much hype and talk. And I don't know about you guys, but I think in real practice, very few doctors actually treat NPDR without edema.
Well, so I'm going to zag though, because would you think that would be different though, if you went and pulled doctors and say, hey, you treat them once and they're 95% of them are good for life? Not to say either of those will hit that number, but I told you, hey, you're a moderate to severe NPDR patient. You can give them an injection once and they're 90% protected for the rest of their life. I think if you could get it approved, most people would think about it, right?
Yeah, I definitely think that the value is there compared to, you know, monthly or bi-monthly or quarterly even injections, for sure. It's probably going to be something that's expensive though, because the way, you know, people, companies usually price these out, they compare it to what would it have cost if we were doing like monthly Eylea injections, and that's how we're going to price it. It's usually how it goes, I believe.
Yes, and in that case, it will be interesting to see how the system could handle that. Sarwar, your thoughts? I mean, because to the point, I always thought one of the disadvantages to VEGF inhibition potentially via gene therapy is we don't have a good way yet of turning it off, right? So you do have VEGF inhibition, but can you turn it off if you need to? There's been back and forth debate over years if excess VEGF inhibition in wet AMD is a good or a bad thing, right? And maybe if it was negative, what would you do about it? That's my one concern about the AMD space. I'm actually opposite of Yoshi. I actually think the more applicable patient population is the DR population, because you can get to patients before they have damage and they don't have the atrophy happening to them, although they can get macular ischemia, which in that SAT analogy, I guess macular ischemia is to DME as geographic atrophy is to CNVM and exudation and wet AMD. I think it's potentially exciting. Again, The thing is, it has to be something that's easily implementable. And I like that both of these are in-office options versus subretinal, which has been discussed, you know, for gene therapy previously.
I thought it was really interesting what you said, what you both said about, you know, applying this in the absence of macular edema. Because I think that's the whole thing with the panorama trial, right? I mean, like, it's great to be able to avoid some of those
Oh, and
neovascular complications. Go ahead.
let's go non-industry to protocol W as well, right? So, yeah,
Absolutely.
both. Yeah.
So, I mean, part of the reason that, you know, we don't, you know, a lot of people are not treating in PDR. And listen, I mean, these are great studies. And I, you know, if we can actually reduce the risk of DME, we have, in addition to us having wanting buy-in, we also have to have patients have buy-in, right? You know, a lot of these, you know, DR treatment options, you know, for a patient may just feel like a cosmetic procedure, right? Yeah, like the picture looks better when they come back, you know, a month or 2 months later. You know, they may not necessarily feel an improvement, which they do when we treat DR, which is, I think it's not just resistance from physicians, it's also resistance from, not necessarily resistance from, you know, we also have to tell our patients, like, yes, there's going to be a real benefit. And in a way, this is similar to the conversation we have about GA, right? I mean, it's like, okay, this is an injection that will reduce your rate of visual decline. You won't notice anything, but you'll notice we're trying to prove a negative here. This thing that got bigger from here to here is going to, you know, get bigger, smaller. You know, when we try to educate these patients, these are long conversations. I would envision that this is a pretty long conversation too. You know, so it's analogous because it's the same sort of model that we use. It's like, oh, this is slowing the rate of decline, you know? So, I mean, maybe, you know, the not having the DME is definitely great. Not having the vitreous hemorrhage and tractional detachments is great. But I agree, the not being able to turn it off is interesting. This article talks a lot about the actual sort of shelf life of some of these injections. And I think that's interesting because if there was a way that, okay, with cell division or, you know, with maybe immune clearance, some of the effects sort of attenuated. It's sort of like the question that I have with whenever I use Iluvien, it's like, all right, this is there for 3 years. I can't turn this thing off. You know, there's a possibility that there's an IOP issue. You know, it's the main thing that we worry about with intraocular steroids. You know, it would be nice if there were a known endpoint. I don't think we know with some of these newer medications, and I think that makes it complicated. Also, from a practice management standpoint, you know, this is, I was actually having this conversation within the last week or so about how we as retina specialists, you know, with these longer acting agents, whether it's gene therapy or, you know, depots or, you know, some sort of gel that delivers medicine over a long period of time, that's less injections, less patients coming through our clinic. And someone mentioned, it's like, yeah, we got to start doing premium IOLs and cataract surgery soon because, you know, unfortunately, you know, not only do we have sort of scope battles with like our comprehensive colleagues doing some of these injections, you know, these are less patients going through our clinics. And from a practice management standpoint and sort of the scope of our practice, it may affect how many patients are coming through because these patients don't need us anymore, which is great from a Hippocratic oath and doing what's right for the patient standpoint. But for a business that's trying to sort of maintain liquidity, it's a different calculation.
I don't view that ever as an issue. I view no matter what we fix to solve a problem, there will always be another problem. Not to be fatalistic about it, but and Yoshi, you can make a final comment. But I feel like there will never be a shortage of something. It's fun to dream of a panacea. I don't think that even if this is effective, as even as effective as saying that would fix all the potential issues a patient with diabetic retinopathy could have. Especially, you know, Yoshi, we see so many patients. Actually, if you look at the trials, significant number of patients, they develop DME, they don't respond to anti-VEGF. So then, you know, you may be using it for retinopathy, but you may not get full response. Not every single patient has regression of severity scores. It's just more likely to get regression with treatment than without treatment.
Yep, I agree. I think it will be a game changer if it can be successfully deployed. But it won't change the landscape too much because patients will still need to see us. We'll need to get treatments every now and then for a good number of them. And the retina is, you know, it's one part of of a small organ in your body, but it has many ways that it can go wrong, and we are always going to fix it.
So to that point, and the last thing, I know we're running over, but just for the listeners, I think this is interesting. This is one of those pro-con debates that they'll have in retinal physician. I really enjoy these. Michael Colicello edits, and this is a controversy in care, and they have essentially a pro-con debate which is chlorhexidine versus povidone iodine, betadine versus chlorhexidine for antisepsis and endophthalmitis. And the reason I like this, I feel like sometimes at meetings, they do the pro-con, we've all done this, but sometimes a little hokey, like you take people who don't actually believe or do what they have to argue, but they have to go up there and argue it. But actually, I think they took two sides that this is how they practice, right? Dr. Harry Flynn Bascom, I know very well, one of my mentors, who was on the side of, you know, povidone iodine is the standard of care, chlorhexidine should be second line. And then Dr. Sunil Garg, ironically, one of my mentors, so I can also speak to this, who talks about his transition to using chlorhexidine and the pros and cons of using chlorhexidine. And there's literature presented on both sides for those who read it. I think we've seen two recent papers in the last year, one of which showed no difference in infectious rates and one that showed a slight increase in infectious rate in the chlorhexidine group. So different studies, not apples to oranges comparisons. Yoshi, you are at Sunir Garg's practice. Chlorhexidine is used. What are your thoughts on povidone iodine versus chlorhexidine? Does it make a difference? Can you use them equivalently, assuming there's no allergy to either one? What are your thoughts about this debate?
Sure. Thinking back, like when we were medical students, you know, SAR-RJ, like, you know, 15 years ago, I remember seeing the attendings use an entire bottle of betadine, just like dousing the eye. You know, the eye was draped with a speculum, entire bottle of betadine. That's how people rolled, right? And it may be interesting to talk about how we do it now. I'm sure we're much more cornea friendly now. And personally, it's two drops for most of my patients in our practice. We all use betadine first line, one by the tech as the patient's getting ready, let it simmer. And I come in, and then right before I do the injection, I personally do one more drop while holding the lids right where I'm going to do the injection and make sure that the patient doesn't, you know, blink so that the lid margin doesn't go over it. And I do the injection. So it's two drops basically for me. And the vast majority of my patients are totally okay with this. And if patients have discomfort, you know, next time I'll be rinsing it. I don't have any patient who has like refused to get injections, but you know, every now and then you may have in your practice. And I know Sunir Garg has done great studies about this. The vast majority of patients do get betadine, and it's a small minority. And it's number one, the difficulties with it is that I believe the data that it's more comfortable and it's better for the corneal epithelium. But it has to be number one, compounded. There's two versions. There's a compounded version. And the beyond use date, so the expiration date is 28 days, right? So you have to buy a new bottle every single time per injection. And it's like $100, whether it's you buying it or the patient buying it. And there's a commercially available one also that's alcohol-based, as the article mentioned, but that's only good for 24 hours. And I just want to drop this little information here because a lot of people ask me, where do you guys get your chlorhexidine?
And I was just predicting the emails from this podcast. I get so many messages. Anytime it gets mentioned in the podcast, I get emails from people asking.
Yeah. So let me just drop it here. I think I'm allowed to. We get it from O'Brien's Pharmacy in Kansas.
O'Brien's Pharmacy in Kansas, not a sponsor, no disclosures. O'Brien's Pharmacy in Kansas is where you can get your chlorhexidine. Relationship.
Yeah. And here's their number. Their
Smack
number
dab is... in the middle of the country, the only place that will be standing when the floods come.
Yep. And so their number is 1-800-627-4360.
Are you you're sure you don't have a disclosure, Yoshi? It's a lot of information you're dropping.
Wait, I knew we were talking about this article.
What was the number again? Sorry, I cut it off the end.
Are you sure? Okay, all right. 1-800-627-4360.
Call now and save 20%. 1-800. No, I'm just kidding.
Yoshi,
no,
has to record the song.
Yeah,
the commercial 1-800.
Come to O'Brien's,
you know?
Chlorhexidine. Come to O'Brien's. Your eyes are so clean.
O'Brien's.
Oh, God.
That was great.
Oh,
sorry.
Man, don't get us started. I'm getting punchy. It is Friday afternoon. Yeah, I mean, look, we can talk very briefly about injection technique. We're way over, but just because I think there's so much variability. I got a text yesterday from someone saying, you know, do you prep the lashes? Because I think a lot of protocols talk about lash prep. I think we all agree most of the bacteria actually for injections doesn't come from the lashes. It comes from oral flora. But the next most common after oral flora will be your lash bacteria, coagulative staph. So Yoshi, it's funny. I migrated away. I do not do betadine in the lashes because I find most patients really don't like it. It causes a lot of, even in non-allergic patients, a lot of inflammation, a lot of unnecessary allergy. My big thing is lid retraction, whether using a speculum or manually. And then I do also two drops on the side to make sure the first drop sits for at least 30 seconds to a minute to make sure it evaporates and causes those cell membranes of the bacteria to lyse. And then I really make sure the lashes do not touch that site once betadine is touched on it. And I go very focally right over the site of injection, not all over the cornea, because it doesn't make sense to prep the whole eye when you're going to one place, assuming that things aren't moving around. So once you sort of mobilize picking that paste focally, and I'll tell you, I have a bunch of patients. I had a bunch of patients in Miami who were betadine, quote unquote, allergic and intolerant, and very few had a true allergy. They were just very resistant and tolerant to betadine. And I would honestly sometimes just soak a cotton tip in betadine and press directly on the site, do that two or three times, and they would tolerate it a lot better. And then knock on wood, again, you need a lot of numbers to get endophthalmitis, so I'm not going to jinx myself, but didn't really have major issues. And I think it's been an evolution, Sarwar. Where I think that it's a number needed to treat, right? We don't want to get infections, but I think our understanding of what causes infections, I again may continue to evolve. What I say now in 5 years, maybe there's some data that comes up debunks it. I just don't see that many patients who are betadine intolerant where I feel the need to switch to chlorhexidine. And then there's no sort of cost benefit in our system to getting chlorhexidine over betadine to what Yoshi was talking about. So I just haven't felt the impetus. I just think it depends on how you utilize your prep. And if you're utilizing your prep like you're taking a shower in it, more power to you. I'm not criticizing you despite the way I say phrase that, but then maybe it does make sense to do something that's tolerated better than by the cornea like chlorhexidine.
Yeah, it's a great point. I mean, I think one of the tough things is, I also don't have too many patients that are betadine, quote unquote, intolerant. And it's always silly when people say that they have a shellfish allergy or they're allergic to their native iodine. So it's like for me, I actually, from a practice management standpoint, it's not necessarily always sustainable, unless you have a reliable source. Betadine is something we've been using. I actually do prep the lids and lashes. I have one of those three packs of 10% betadine. So that, I usually what I do, I put in a drop of anesthetic, and before I utilize subconj. Before the subconj goes in the eye, there's a drop of betadine that goes into the eye. I don't like the idea of introducing anything even in the subconj space. Maybe it's overkill. And then I do the subconj, and then 5 minutes later, I actually prep the lashes. I should start charging as it like as a blepharitis treatment, because I'm pretty sure it's going to be helping the blepharitis on the injected side. And I usually, similar to what you do with the 5% betadine, put it on a Q-tip at the injection site, or actually a drop if a patient's able to tolerate it. And then I do the injection. And then I flush it out, and I just an aggressive irrigation is usually good enough. What I do is probably overkill, but I like the idea of getting the lashes. I don't know, maybe I should just make it into a cash pay blepharitis treatment and have all these oculoplastics and derm people and ocular surface people come and try to cancel me for taking their business,
there was a study that may patients who get injections, their meibomian gland dysfunction improves, and that was like a big data study too.
Yeah.
So keep
There you
doing your
go.
things that
There
you
way.
go.
I just don't know what to say. I had uncomfortable laughter at Star Wars blepharitis treatment clinic, because I don't I you know that's a mafia out there, and I just don't want to upset them, get a hit put on my family. I'm going to get threatening boxes of Avita wipes with holes in them put on my front porch. I'm just not going to do it. So I'm going to leave it there. I'm going to wake up and just covered in baby shampoo one morning, wondering what happened to me.
Yeah.
So anyway, I appreciate you guys coming on. And again, the chlorhexidine thing, Yoshi said the number twice on the podcast, but if you didn't hear it and you email me, I will forward it to Yoshi. I don't use chlorhexidine routinely. I don't order it for our hospital, but I'm happy to be your conduit information, because I probably get more chlorhexidine related emails a year than anything else. It more emails from chlorhexidine than sometimes from my family members. It really makes me rethink my life priorities. Yoshi and Sarwar, thanks so much for joining, and have a wonderful Memorial Day weekend.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Jay. Thanks, Yoshi.
Many thanks to our correspondents for joining us for this episode. Thank you, listeners, for listening to our podcast, for providing us content to discuss, publishing articles, for inspiring us with the conversations that we take very seriously on this podcast every week, and for taking care of patients, doing a great job at what you do on a daily basis. Remember, you have 431 episodes archived in your podcast app or online at the website retinapodcast.com. That's retinapodcast.com. Thanks to our whole production team, Drs. Justin Ma, Mike Minicasa, Angela Chang, and Louis Kai. And I hope to see you guys all back here next week. This is Jay Schreeder signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.